Yes, thank you. Thank you very much for this introduction. So I'll tell you about something that indeed I think is fun, and which is why I went in this direction of more astrophysics than I would normally do. And I will talk about charged particle astronomy. Now, charged particle astronomy is different from normal astronomy in that charged particles are bent on their way from the source to the detector. And so you learn a lot more about the space in between than you do about sources. Until you figure out what's in between, you can't really study the sources very well. But I'll tell you what we have learned along the way, and I think it's exciting enough. So just worked and stopped. Anyway. All right. So what are the sources? So there are these numerous sources that could produce strong fluxes of charged particles. One type is active galactic nuclei, which are supermassive black holes sitting in the centers of their respective galaxies and devouring stellar matter. And as the stellar matter comes into the black hole, it forms the accretion disk. And as it approaches the black hole and gets closer and closer, it has to get rid of energy and angular momentum. And it does so by creating a very powerful jet pointing perpendicular to the plane of the accretion disk. And in that jet, there are shock waves that accelerate particles to high energy. And I'll mention one mechanism which people think they understand. And this is a very, very bright source, both in cosmic rays and in gamma rays. And there are many of them in the sky. The point here is just an example. There are supernova remnants in our and other galaxies. And these supernova remnants have also outgoing shock waves that can accelerate particles and produce fluxes of charged particles. There are pulsars in our own galaxy, which can also be accelerators. If you think about a magnetic field of 10 to the 12 Gauss, just a dipole that rotates with a period of several milliseconds, then, of course, just the voltage from the surface of the pulsar to infinity is 10 to the 15 to 10 to the 20 volts. Now, you cannot accelerate a particle to 10 to the 15, 10 to the 20 electron volts because there are losses that limit the effective lengths over which you can accelerate. But these are powerful sources. And in fact, gamma ray burst, which now we know to be of extragalactic origin, they first were suspected to be the result of pulsar accelerating particles. Gamma ray bursts were discovered by accident when the U.S. government launched a satellite to monitor nuclear non-proliferation so that any nuclear explosion on Earth would be detected by its gamma ray emission. And they observed bursts of gamma rays essentially once a day. It was quickly realized that nobody was testing nuclear weapons on Earth once a day, and that these bursts must have come from elsewhere in the universe. But for a while, people didn't know whether these were local galactic sources of gamma ray flashes, of very powerful gamma ray flashes, or these were extragalactic, ridiculously powerful sources of gamma rays. And it turned out to be the latter. Now, there is no doubt that gamma ray bursts occur throughout the universe, and we see an average burst from a redshift of order 1 from, from billions of light years away. And these are very, very powerful sources. There are two types of them that differ dramatically in duration. If you look at the distribution of bursts, it's a two-hump distribution with the first group of bursts shorter than a second, and the other type of bursts longer than a second on average. And the longer gamma ray bursts are probably the explosion of supermassive stars that create a highly collimated beam of gamma rays. And I'll talk about these more because we suspect that the same explosion may have happened in our own galaxy in the past. Short gamma ray bursts are believed to be merger events of neutron stars or a neutron star and a black hole. And again, those should be happening in our own galaxy as well at some rate. And so these are the two types of bursts that people study. And of course, this is a very interesting source. In our own galaxy, we don't have anything like this, although we do have a smaller black hole around 2.5 million solar masses in the center of our galaxy. Okay, so how does the acceleration take place? So this is the cartoon of an active galactic nucleus surrounded by this accreting matter. And I want to just briefly mention the acceleration that people think takes place in the jets. In the jets, we have shock waves that go along the jet. And the charged particles can wander in or out of this shock wave. So they can cross the shock front. If they go in and then get isotropized by the magnetic field that travels with the shock wave, then when they come out, they will have higher energy. Now, this one-time acceleration may not be very important, but if it happens over and over again, you can get particles accelerated to very high energies. Of course, it's only a small fraction of the particles that get to go in and out many times because there is a small probability for the particle to remain in the acceleration region after it got accelerated the first time. So if we do this very simple analysis, we can arrive at a rather general conclusion. So suppose the probability for the particle to remain in the acceleration region is p, and so to do it k times would be associated with the probability p to the k power. And each time the particle gets accelerated by factor beta, so the energy after k accelerations is beta to the k's power times its initial energy. Well, if you remove k from these two relations, you end up with the power law. And this is a very generic prediction. And in fact, if you look at the measured spectrum of cosmic rays, you observe that over many, many decades, it looks like a power law. And that is just a consequence of something happening many times to the particle, some kind of acceleration happening many times. Now, this doesn't tell us very much about the details of that acceleration, but this universal power law spectrum is indicative of something like Fermi shock acceleration probably taking place. Now, this spectrum spans a large number of decades in energy. And even though you can't read the labels, I'll tell you that here, at the end of this spectrum, the energy is macroscopic. The energy of the highest energy of the highest energy cosmic rays observed is equivalent to the energy of a bullet shot from a rifle or of a major league baseball moving at 100 kilometers per hour. So this energy is really macroscopic, but it's carried by a single proton or a single nucleus. Now, to study these fantastic events, one needs very large detectors because the flux here is one particle per square kilometer per century. And so if one doesn't want to wait for many centuries, one needs many square kilometers. And this is how this this detection works. People create very large arrays of detectors, and they cover many square kilometers with essentially two types of detectors. The detectors that collect charged particles on the ground, and the detector that can see the development of shower in the atmosphere. When one of these particles strikes the upper atmosphere, it interacts with the nitrogen nucleus and creates a pancake of charged particles that propagate through the atmosphere. And one can see the ultraviolet radiation from that moving pancake of charged particles and record it, and from the brightness of it, determine how much energy is in the shower, which is telling you the original energy of the particle. Now, this gives me an opportunity to tell you a little-known fact about an atmospheric phenomenon which occurs in Toronto and never occurs in Los Angeles. And, but, you know, even though I came here to observe it, it doesn't seem to be in the forecast for the next couple of days. So it's a lightning. Now, when you show a tabletop experiment with Tesla coils here in this room, and I'm sure that many introductory physics courses use that, the voltage that you need to initiate the breakdown of air is 10 kilovolts per centimeter. This voltage apparently is never attained in the atmosphere. And when people measured this with the balloon experiments, they observed that the voltage goes up to 1 or 2 kilovolts per centimeter. The electric field goes up to 1 or 2 kilovolts per centimeter. And then the lightning occurs and removes the charge. And then the electric field again grows to 1 or 2 kilovolts per centimeter, and another lightning occurs. And this is a very puzzling phenomenon, because if you think about it, I mean, there's not much difference between air out there and air in this room. And the explanation is that there is a runaway breakdown that can be initiated by a large number of fast particles already present for some other reason. So if you consider an electron moving with energy above certain critical energy, which turns out to be a few MeV, this electron interacting with the electron in an atom can knock out a daughter electron and give it also the energy above the critical energy, so that two of them now move with the energy that is sufficient to knock out daughter electrons above the critical energy. And if the acceleration in the electric field between these collisions is sufficient to supply the energy to keep the avalanche above critical, then you have this avalanche of particles coming down and creating essentially a conductor, a conducting path in its wake. So the 10 to the 16 electron volt showers happen often enough and have enough particles to create these conducting channels, which lightnings use to start. And so if there were no cosmic rays, then every lightning, you would have to wait for 10 kilowatts per centimeter to start that lightning. But as the electric field grows, every so often there is a shower that discharges the cloud, and so that's why the electric field never goes up to that value. And of course, here we don't have the showers of charged particles going through because the ceiling protects us. So you have to be out in the open air, but you don't want to be in the open air all the time. And so in Malargüe, Argentina, where the biggest existing cosmic ray detector was built, there's this nice building, and it's in a little town called Malargüe, next to the Andes, in the Pampas. And then this huge piece of land, about 50 kilometers is its scale here, is covered with water tank detectors and is overlooked by several fluorescent telescopes. The headquarters are here in Malargüe. The closest town where you can fly by a commercial airline is Mendoza, which is 5 hours drive in the northern direction. And Mendoza is where the good Argentinian Malbecs come from. So you probably see it on the label of wine you buy in the local store. But this is, you know, it's a beautiful area. There is some ski area here. I think it's actually on this side of the road. And it's also famous for other reason, because if you read the book by Peter Paul, Alive, and there was also a movie Alive about a plane crash in the mountains. It happened on the mountain just about here. So it's a plane crash in which half the passengers survived by eating the other half. And then eventually they hiked out of the mountains, and they didn't know they were closer to the site of Piaget experiment. They actually went to the other side. They went to Chile, eventually were saved that way. So this is the site of Piaget detector from one of these fluorescent telescopes, and you can see white dots here and here and here. So it's, there are lines of white dots. You can see 1, 2, 3, which are the water tanks. So this whole area of Pampas is covered by water tanks. So the site was chosen because one wants to be sufficiently high in the atmosphere to catch the particles before they lost all their energy, and one wants to be in the area where the weather is often nice, and one wants to be in a flat area like this. So that's why they chose this piece of Pampas. This is the water tank, and the human being, same as here, next to the water tank for scale. So this water tank has everything you can imagine. It has 3 photomultipliers looking downward into the tank. It has solar panel. It has GPS antenna, so it knows the time. It knows where it's located. And wherever it is hit with a large number of particles, it sends a friendly signal using this communication antenna to the main center where it is analyzed. And at the same time, these fluorescent telescopes at night have their gates open, and photomultipliers collect light and analyze the propagation of shower in the atmosphere. You need to know how transparent the atmosphere is, and so for this purpose they have LIDAR, which is a laser which can be shot in any direction, and they can measure the transparency of the atmosphere. And on the ground, when many tanks are firing, the footprint of a big shower looks like this, and people can analyze the number of particles and figure out the energy and where it's coming from. So this is one detection concept. Another concept that is more futuristic was proposed but never built, not yet anyway. It's an extreme universal space observatory. And the idea is to put a camera on a space station or as a free flyer in low Earth orbit and look downward on the atmosphere. And then as the shower develops in the atmosphere, one can record the light going through the atmosphere. And then at the end, there is this flash of Cherenkov light, because a lot of light is focused in the forward direction. The Cherenkov light is focused in the forward direction. And when it hits the ocean, it reflects back and creates this little flash, and it helps reconstruct the shower. So this is a futuristic project, and I don't know whether it will ever fly, but at present, it's Piaget that produces most of the data and provides us with all these data that we can use to study cosmic rays of the highest energies. There is another experiment. There was another experiment, high-resolution FlySci in Utah, which operated until 2006, and now there is a new detector being built there called Telescope Array, which, again, uses the same concept of hybrid detection with water tanks, with detectors on the ground, a surface detector, and fluorescent detector. So now I'm going to tell you about some interesting things that we have learned from the data. And one very surprising and very recent discovery that Piaget detector made was that at the highest energies, there are more and more nuclei. So if you measure the depth of the shower, that tells you how deep in the atmosphere the first collision occurred. And that parameter differs statistically for protons and heavier nuclei. So one can measure the composition. Unfortunately, there are fluctuations that prevent you from measuring composition on a case-by-case basis, on event-by-event basis. But statistically, you can tell whether you have mostly protons, mostly nuclei, or a mixture thereof. And anybody in the right mind would not have predicted that at the higher energies, you should have more nuclei, because it just doesn't fit with that model of acceleration that I mentioned. Think about it this way. If there is a way to accelerate a charged particle, in any system, there should be more protons than any astrophysical system anyway. There should be more protons available for injection than nuclei. And the field of photons at the site of the accelerator should force nuclei to disintegrate into protons. And so any astrophysical accelerator would probably be happier accelerating protons at the highest energies than accelerating nuclei. So what is happening? Well, if it is hard to imagine that an accelerator would produce these particles, maybe the propagation can affect the results in such a way that we detect nuclei more often than protons. Can that be the case? Well, this actually is possible. This is possible if the sources are within our own galaxy. Because what is special about sitting inside a galaxy is that we have a lot of turbulent galactic fields of the microgauss strengths around us. And if we had a source within our own galaxy producing both protons and nuclei, then it is likely that protons would escape from galactic magnetic fields more easily, and the nuclei would be trapped. If you can see this actually from this simple relation for the diffusion time, which is greater for nuclei with a large Z number than it is for protons. But there isn't anything like an active galactic nucleus in our own galaxy. Our galaxy is actually a very quiet and comfortable place to live, at least recently. Now, we don't know what went on, say, a million years ago. And if some very unusual supernova or gamma ray bursts of the type that we observe in other galaxies happened in our own Milky Way every 10 to the 5 years or so, then these events can inject particles that eventually diffuse and populate the galactic halo, and which we eventually detect. Okay, so these are actually more or less the same events. GRBs or gamma ray bursts, as referred to observed phenomena, and also the sources that produce these gamma rays in great numbers. Theorists have proposed more than one model for the central engine, and these go by the names of hypernova or collapsar or other unusual supernova explosions, all of which refer to long gamma ray bursts. But do these really occur in our galaxy? Do we have hypernova in our own galaxy? Well, the first evidence of hypernova, I think, comes from the local music store. You can buy a CD by Hypernova, but it is suspiciously titled Fairy Tales. So I don't know if I can use that as evidence. However, GRBs in our own galaxies have been proposed to explain some unusual phenomena. Well, first, GRBs were are considered as sources of ultra-high-energy cosmic rays of extragalactic origin. Now, that explanation, this explanation has problems with energetics, but there's little doubt that GRBs can accelerate particles. But in our own galaxy, if we have these sources of high-energy photons and electrons and positrons, they can possibly be involved in explaining some of the anomalies that people observed. For example, there is a 511 keV line from the galactic center which indicates a large number of positrons injected into the galactic bulge. And there is also very dramatic observation by Pamela and Fermi of the higher than expected flux of electrons and positrons at the higher energies. So these may be related to galactic gamma ray bursts. So let me not apologize for using equations, because this is a physics colloquium. So let me just see how the propagation can affect the observed fluxes of particles. I'll write the propagation, the transport equation, and then I will neglect everything I can possibly neglect in this transport equation. In this transport equation, I have dt dn equals something. So let me suppose that it is a constant flux. So dn dt, n being the number of particles, is constant. So dn dt is zero. Let me also assume that the particles don't interact. They just diffuse after they are produced by the source with this function Q. And so I just have diffusion and the source. And for the source function, I'll assume that everything happens in the center of the galaxy and that I produce a power law spectrum of particle, because we already know that power law is a good function to use in this context. Now, if I neglect everything except these two terms, then everyone in this room can solve this equation and obtain the number of particles as something divided by the diffusion constant. And let me remind you what diffusion constant is. It's just the distance divided by 3 over which the particle changes its direction by order 1. So suppose I have a very simple model of diffusion. I have clouds filled with magnetic fields in our own galactic environment. And these magnetic fields point randomly, because these are just turbulent magnetic fields. And so particles hit charged particles hit these magnetic fields, turn around, come out, fly further. Now, there are two possible regimes here. If the Larmor radius is smaller than the size of a typical cloud, then one cloud is enough to turn the particle by angle order 1. On the other hand, if the Larmor radius is much larger, then there are small changes in the angle, and they are random. And so it's a random walk problem. And then it takes quadratically more interactions to change the direction of the particle by angle order 1. So there's this fundamental change in the way magnetic fields affect the directions of particles, which occurs when the Larmor radius is comparable to the size of this cloud. But the Larmor radius is a function of z of the nucleus. And so the critical energy for this change of behavior in the microgauss field is suspiciously close to the energy range in which we're trying to explain this unusual change in composition. So it's tempting to try to explain the number of particles we observed by the change in the diffusion constant. And it changes, you see, from something that's almost constant to something that's quadratic in energy, quadratic coming from random walk, the square root and the random walk. So if you just do a random, throw in random parameters and consider protons, carbon, and iron nuclei accelerated in the same way and inject it in the same way, then starting with some energy, you start losing protons, then you start losing carbon, and then you start losing iron. And these energies depend on the Z number of the nucleus. And you actually can get a very interesting change in composition right around the energies where it's observed. And one with a more realistic distribution of sources, one can try to reproduce Piaget spectrum. So for the long GRBs, one can take the distribution of stars in the galaxy as a good tracer of GRB positions. And for short GRBs, one can actually use observational data for short GRBs. And you can see that that happens more out in the halo, because that's where the neutron stars collide. All neutron stars which are also observed as pulsars, have very large velocities. They come out of the galactic plane and fly out in the halo, which is where they collide. And so we modeled this numerically, and as you can see, these points are Piaget data. We reproduce the spectrum very well, and we reproduce the change in composition just by assuming galactic sources. So what we are probably observing is the evidence of past gamma ray burst explosions in our own galaxy. Now, this is like astrophysical archaeology. We're looking at the evidence of fossils of something that happened over the last, you know, once in a million years. I had to the iron nuclei here are produced at the level of 10% as compared to proton, right? So you get the reasonable fit at 10%. Of course, this is just an illustration of an idea, because no one expects the spectrum to have just two components. If you have iron, it will photodisintegrate. You'll produce anything in between photon and proton and iron. And to get a realistic fit, one would have to consider all these nuclear reactions in the photon field of our own galaxy, and one has to consider losses properly. And this is what we're doing now with my Japanese collaborators in a horrendous numerical simulation, which will soon produce results. But of course, you know, one can illustrate the idea in a very, you know, concise way, which is what we did in this PRL. And one can ask, okay, so what about galactocentric anisotropy? The sources are crowded in the direction of galactic center. Can we see anisotropy in the fluxes of cosmic rays? Turns out that this anisotropy is large in protons, but small in nuclei. And since we observe mostly nuclei at high energy, there is this change, crossover from protons to nuclei, and we don't observe more than few percent anisotropy. And at present, we don't quite have enough data to observe this anisotropy. However, the most recent, so since we're doing archaeology here, the most recent and nearby gamma ray bursts should show up as hotspots. And so some small-scale anisotropy, some clusters of events which we already observe in the data, may show up as, you know, these simulated hotspots from the recent GRBs. So we're trying to figure out this story, and this is in the Kurosawa's movie, where there's the same event is described more than once. So either one can see this extragalactic sources, which accelerate our nuclei more than protons, and for reasons we don't understand, or there is this alternative explanation with galactic sources, which produce more protons than nuclei as expected, but the propagation in our own galaxy favors the nuclei over protons and lets the protons go out once the energies reach 10 to the 18 electron volts. The same would have interesting implications for paleontology. Another parallel with archaeology here, because gamma ray bursts in our own galaxy are probably very dramatic events, and cosmic rays, you know, those protons that have gone out of the galaxy may have caused changes in the Earth atmosphere. And this is an interesting connection. It's not fully understood yet what cosmic rays do to the atmosphere. For example, there is an experiment called CLOUD at CERN, where people study the rate at which aerosols form in the air depending on the fluxes of cosmic rays. And the more ionizing radiation you have, the more readily aerosols form. And of course, aerosols are important for global climate change. For example, the reason, there's a common misconception. People say, well, my car can't possibly affect the climate more than volcanoes. But the truth is, volcanoes don't cause global warming. Volcanoes spit out more aerosols than they do, than they produce carbon dioxide. And aerosols cause cooling because they shade light. They don't trap, have the greenhouse effect. So the change in the flux of cosmic rays can cause can alter the atmosphere, can cause various effects, and may be related to past extinctions. We don't know for sure, but people are looking into these connections. Well, in addition to charged particle detectors, we also have a way of detecting high-energy photons produced in the same sources. Can we adopt some kind of a holistic approach and study both and figure something out? Well, in the same jets, the accelerated particles can upscale the background photons and produce very high-energy photons. Those are also detected in a slightly different way, but also using the atmospheric showers. When a high-energy gamma ray comes in, it initiates a shower that produces a lot of Cherenkov light, and the fluxes of photons are greater than the fluxes of these ultra-energy cosmic rays, so one doesn't need many square kilometers. One can build a very big dish or set of dishes and observe this Cherenkov light. And there are three leading instruments in this field, HESS, MAGIC, and Veritas, that observe gamma ray sources and provide very interesting information. In particular, this is the observation of HESS in black points and of MAGIC and Veritas, blue and red points here, of a very distant blazar. Blazar is just an active galactic nucleus with a jet pointing at us, which shows up in the lack of spectral lines because the jet is just pointing at us and we just see the usual power laws instead of lines. So this is a spectrum that extends to 10 TeV energy, to huge energies. And there's something very surprising about this spectrum. If you stare at the spectrum for a while, you'll see that it's extremely surprising. Well, it's power law, and there's no sign of any absorption at high energies. But at some energy, at some point, for these very, very distant sources, you expect that the spectrum starts showing the signs of absorption because these gamma rays may interact with extragalactic background light, which is a long word for starlight, or reprocessed starlight, and produce a plus and minuses and lose energy. So you should be losing photons just about here. Now, it may be that these sources that are more distant actually have harder initial spectra that make up for that, but it doesn't sound very plausible. However, we know that the same objects probably accelerate cosmic rays. And so one can ask, what would be the effect of the cosmic rays going through the same huge distance and interacting with the starlight and producing electromagnetic cascade, which we observe as secondary photons? And it's actually remarkable that you get a very good fit with just a one-parameter fit with the unknown luminosity of the same active galactic nucleus in protons if you take into account these additional secondary photons. So we probably are seeing, for these very distant sources, we're probably seeing the secondary photons produced by cosmic rays, which confirms indirectly the ability of active galactic nuclei to accelerate protons. Finally, I'll tell you something that I find very exciting, and that is the our recent discovery of intergalactic magnetic fields, which turn out to be femtogauss in strength. Now, we knew where to look for them because this explanation for the spectra would only work if magnetic fields were 10 to the minus 14 gauss or smaller. And there were other indications that they should be 10 to the 15 or larger. And at 10 to the minus 15, if you look at this diagram, so a photon can interact with the background photons, produce semi plus and minus pairs, and then they upscatter photons and produce new photons. But every high energy photon we observe spends some time along the way as a charged particle. And if there is magnetic field that deflects these charged particles, then their arrival directions should deviate from a straight line. And instead of a point source, we expect to see diffuse sources. But the data are very scarce from each of these extragalactic, if we take Fermi data, Fermi observes many, many sources at once, but it observes only a few photons per source. So let me use an analogy to tell you what we did. So this is a picture of a halo around the sun. And here's another picture of a halo around the sun, which occurs on a nice winter day when there are ice crystals in the air. And these ice crystals deflect light and cause these halos to appear. Now, suppose you wanted to detect the presence of ice crystals at night. Of course, the stars have halos of their own, but each of them just have too few photons to show up. How would you deal with the data collected at night if you wanted to study to detect the presence of these ice crystals? Well, one way to deal with it would be to stack the data. So you take images of many stars and you superimpose them one on top of the other. And then individual fragments of these halos would come together and amplify. And that's what we did. We took 170 images from Fermi, cleaned them out, and that's mostly Shinichiro Ando who did that, and stacked them together and compared it to what we expected to see from a point source. Now, so this is the expected, in two different energy ranges, the expected image of a point source, which is never a point in any real instrument, but this is what you expect. And this is the result of stacking 170 of those sources. And clearly, you can see by eye that there is some deflection caused by something, presumably intergalactic magnetic fields, and then one can go through some different checks and see how it scales with energy and with redshift and convince oneself that these are not instrumental effects, that these are real and that they are consistent with intergalactic magnetic fields of these femtogauss strings. So even from the imperfect images, we are able to learn something about the universal backgrounds and magnetic fields in the intergalactic space. Now, these magnetic fields are very small, and they probably have existed there since long before the stars and galaxies formed. So this may be a new window on the physics of the early universe where seed magnetic fields were produced. So let me conclude here by summarizing that we're looking at that the cosmic ray astronomy and gamma ray astronomy are providing exciting new data. We are learning from this data about the acceleration of cosmic rays, about the intergalactic magnetic fields and extragalactic background light, the photon backgrounds that permeate the universe. And we're learning and finding some evidence of these massive explosions in our own galaxy that probably happened with a frequency of once per million years or several times per million years. And undoubtedly, this field will foster more discoveries in the future. Thank you.